Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. We love making this show, and we hope you enjoy listening to it, too.
If you'd like to support us, head over to patreon.com/grapesandgrain. For $1 a month, you can be our drinking buddy, where you get a shout-out on air. For $3 a month, be our happy hour date, where you get a post-season happy hour invite.
And our top tier is called Pick Your Poison, where donors get to pick the topic that we discuss on an upcoming show.
Go to patreon.com/grapesandgrain and make your monthly contribution now.
Cheers, y'all. Hello, and welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teeny.
And I'm Laura, and this podcast is about our favorite thing in the world.
Alcoholic beverages. Today, we're going to do something a little different. Grapes and Grain is technically between seasons, but that does not mean the party's over. Laura and I are both going on super boozy adventures this fall, and those will set the stage for season three.
Yep, I am headed to the well-loved and renowned Willamette Valley in Oregon from September through pretty much the end of the year to do what's actually going to be my second vintage, and I cannot be more excited. And Teeny is going to head overseas to Germany. She's going to see her family and visit Oktoberfest as well. So before we go, we just wanted to give you a little sneak peek into what we'll be up to and what we're in for.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And of course, we don't want you to miss us too much. So this episode, we will be taking a walk on the wine side and hearing about all of Laura's exciting vintage adventures, both past and future. But before we get started, Laura, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Okay, so today I have Corvallis Cellars 2017 Pinot Noir from Willamette Valley, Oregon. So Corvallis is a city in southwest Willamette, but I believe it's bottled in Dundee, Oregon, which is also in the Willamette Valley. No special reason I chose this wine, really, other than because Pinot Noirs are like the reason you get Oregon or Willamette Valley wines.
Okay.
That's the wine to get. But this one specifically is, it's really nice. It's 13.5% and actually super easy to drink.
Oh, yeah?
It tastes like black cherry and raspberry. It has really rosy and floral notes. It's a medium bodied and noticeably oaky.
So yeah, you gave me
quintessential.
You gave me a sip earlier and it's very bright and like juicy and
Juicy. Yeah, it's very
like
fruit forward.
Fun loving.
Yes,
the vibe I get from that wine.
Excellent. Well, Teeny, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Today, I'm actually really excited about the beer that I got. I didn't actually buy it. So fun fact, Laura went to Total Wine today and she bought me a beer.
I did. I picked that one out.
And it's I'm super excited. So this is from Cascade Brewing Company. It's their Primordial Noir. And Laura said she got it for one reason and one reason only. What was that?
Well, you told me to get something from Cascade and then I got it because of the word noir, because I was getting Pinot Noir and that's like totally on the nose for today. So.
Yes. And actually, I'm excited because this beer has quite a bit in common with wine. This beer is a blend, so that's super exciting. The different beers that were blended were Imperial Red Ales that were aged in bourbon barrels and wine barrels for up to 2 years with cherries and spices.
Wow.
Yeah, so holy shit, I expect this to make a statement in my mouth.
So much happening in your description.
Yes.
So wait, it's a red ale, love. It is.
It's multiple red ales.
Multiple red ales, a blend of red ales in bourbon and wine barrels. Not so much love for me, but I understand why people like it. And it was fermented with fruit and spices.
Yeah. So my hunch, I didn't find like exactly how I did that or how they did it. But my guess is there was some of the same beer in bourbon barrels. There was some in wine barrels and they blended those. And then they were both aged with cherry and spices.
Gotcha.
And
gotcha.
Then they blended those two beers together.
Well, how is it?
It's great. Actually, I want to tell you a little bit about the brewery first.
Oh, please do. Please do.
I try it.
I love context.
Yes. So this is a 10.5% ABV. Cascade actually started, they're from Portland, if I didn't say that already, started as a restaurant and brew pub in 1998, but now they have two locations, including a barrel house and tap room where sours like this one are poured straight from the barrel.
Mm.
So like you go and you order this beer and they're going to go over to
the
barrel with a spout and open it. So it's like fresh off the wood.
Woo.
Which I've never had before or heard of before.
Yeah.
And I want to do that.
Okay.
So
fresh off the wood.
Their blending facility is also ginormous. It's part of their distribution center, and they have 1,300 oak barrels there. So this beer is really interesting looking. It's like brown with like plum or Merlot hues.
It is. It's brown, but it's still pretty like hazy too.
It's super hazy.
It's not like a clear brown.
It's cloudy for sure. Mm. And you can really smell the funk on that.
Let me see.
That smell is directly from the bacteria in the wood.
Oh, I like it, though. It's so, like, forest floor, like, lush organ. Like, I feel like I'm walking on pine needles and...
It is funk.
Ooh, I'm excited for y'all's mouths. How has it been? What do you think?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's really, really sour.
Ooh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's good. It's got, like, the fruit really, really shines. I think the fruit is what sort of balances it out.
Did it say what kind of cherry? Was it just black cherry or, like, tart cherry or...
Let's see. It just says cherries. Oh, on the website it said Bing cherries?
Bing cherries.
Do you know what that is?
I do know what that is. Just that it is a type of cherry that you can get compared to other cherries.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know exactly what that meant. Like, I knew it was a type, but...
Yeah, and I think maybe it grows in Washington a lot.
That would make sense. Yeah, they at their restaurant, they use only Northwestern-grown ingredients, so they're very local-focused.
I like that.
But I like that they're available here. That's a far way to go.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to visit that place when I go out there.
I know. You're about to go far away. You have a far way to go.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool. It's not too far.
Well,
it's right in our own back pocket, kind of, as America.
Yeah. I mean, but you're going to go on a road trip, you told me, right? Are you excited
I'm
going to
drive there. I am. So I was just planning it out yesterday. We're going to go to Estes Park to visit our friend on her birthday. Going to head on to Moab, to Jackson Hole, to Yellowstone, through Washington, Idaho, through Walla Walla, and then over onto Oregon for about like 7 or 8 days before.
It's going to be so
beautiful. Right? I'm pretty pumped.
Yeah. Well, and like you mentioned, this is not your first grape harvest season. You spent spring 2019 down under working on vineyards in Australia. So why don't you start by telling me a little bit about where you were and how much time you spent there.
Yep. Okay. So I spent a month of the 2019 Southern Hemisphere vintage in the Barossa Valley in South Australia. So the Barossa Valley is about an hour northeast of Adelaide, which is about like 60 kilometers or 40 miles, depending on your persuasion. So the Barossa Valley is named after the Barossa mountain range behind it. And the valley soil mostly consists of like sandy loam that, you know, drained down from the mountains through the years. And fun story, I actually got to hike to the peak of that mountain range, and it's called Mount Kaiserstuhl.
Nice.
And it was pretty cool. And there's a few towns in the valley, in Barossa Valley, next to the range. And I spent the majority of my time in Angaston, Nuriutba, and Tanunda.
Nice. Where's our nailed it button?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Where is our dinger?
Fumble.
But yeah, so the towns. Yes. So the towns were established in the late 1830s, like 1840s. Angaston was founded by Cornish minders, like Angaston, Anglican, not a far, you know, not super creative. But Tanunda has a loud and proud German history, actually, which I was excited to share with you.
That's amazing.
So Tanunda began by Lutheran settlers from Prussia.
Oh, nice.
Right.
We love Prussia, theme of Prussia on this podcast.
Or like TV Munson and Prussia get like our like constant.
We need to deep dive into those two subjects.
So funny. And even though through the years there was heavy anti-German sentiments in Australia through the First and Second World War by banning immigration, changing street names, stifling the use of the German language, the German heritage and tradition has held on really strong through the Barossa.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And just before you go too far, this is the valley that every time we talk about Australia, it comes up. This is like the it region, right?
Totally. And that's actually why I chose to go there, because it's like when you talk about Australia, why, and you talk about the Barossa Valley, you just do. It's part of the conversation.
Yeah. It's like the Napa of Australia. Is that fair?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know in what way, but sure, that sentiment seems...
I just mean like popularity and reputation.
Yeah,
like
sure.
People like me know it.
I don't know. That was a question. So if it's not fair.
No, I feel like it is. It's not as commercialized or probably as touristy as Napa, because like a lot of the tastings are still complimentary and But it is like the powerhouse, one of the powerhouses of the region.
Okay, that's what I was going for.
Yeah. So actually, there's an interesting like little tidbit about German stuff in the Barossa. There is a dialect of the German language still spoken there called Barossa Deutsch. Mm. And, you know, it's kind of like what happens when a group of people leave a country and continue to speak the language, like isolated from the origin of the language, mm-hmm. like maybe like Creole French.
That's what I was thinking.
Totally. And they both kind of linguistically evolve in their own colorful ways separately. So that happened. And yeah, I don't know. It was really just cool to see that. One of the winemakers took me on a driving tour through all the farms and old family cemeteries, and it was neat.
That's awesome.
Yeah, very Germany. So yeah, I completed an internship with three different wineries out there.
Whoa, that seems like a lot. So were you like, were you winery hopping?
Yeah, so I just needed an internship credit, but I couldn't decide where to do it. So I picked three wineries to do a little over a week with each. One that was very small and organic and boutique, one that was mid-sized, family-owned, and then a larger production facility.
Yeah, like the full spectrum.
Yeah, that was what I was going for.
Well done.
Yeah, so I spent the first part of my internship with Small Fry Wines. They are an organic and biodynamic vineyard and winery. Spent most of my time in the vineyard there with them picking grapes, mainly Cabernet Sauvignon and Mourvedre, which is also called Matero in Australia. And they were very small, although I could not tell you actually the production amount of any of the wineries I was at. They were all very like guarded with that number.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder why.
I don't know. Maybe because I was like not really in. I was only there for like 10 days. So.
Oh, like maybe you're stealing their secrets.
Yeah.
Or you're a spy.
I'd be guarded with my information too. You know what?
I mean, we don't tell people how many downloads our podcast has.
You don't tell me anything.
Right. Yeah. We were talking about that. You keep your hand. So anyways, the second winery, second part of my internship was probably my favorite. It was stayed at a place called Rusden Wines. And I highly recommend if anyone is going to South Australia, the Barossa Valley, please visit Rusden Wines. They are a family of fifth generation grape growers and second generation winemakers, but soon to be third because their oldest daughter is currently in university there studying the family business.
That's so exciting.
So good for her. They use a traditional wood basket press, traditional barrel stacking methods, and wine production techniques. And we're really like my family away from home. So the lead winemaker, Christian, and his family are so passionate about what they do, from safety in the winery to sipping in their glass. And bonus, the head chef and owner of the best restaurant in the Barossa, the Vintners, best friends with the family. So he was over there cooking for us literally all the time. And we were opening badass bottles of wine and just like, I was learning about the culture and the food and wine in this region.
Oh my gosh, you basically got like a Michelin meal.
Yeah, it was so nice, super neat. So, and then the last place of my internship was spent with a company called Soul Growers. It was a group of foremen who left corporate Australia, invested in a winery together, and they were the biggest operation of the three. They did not actually own any vineyards. They bought them from local growers, their fruit.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I used much larger pieces of machinery there, and the volume of wine processed was larger, and the winemaking process was more rigorously scientific here as well.
Okay. Well, you give and you take.
Yeah.
I guess you don't have, like, house grapes, but you do get, like, all the science.
Yeah, yeah. And then they can kind of be picky about, like, who they have a relationship and who they buy from, too, and, mm-hmm. like, what they're looking for. I don't know. So they were very organized in their approach, for sure.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you know, how did you find these gigs? You decided you wanted to go. Mm. What was your process for just reaching out to people?
Well, I have actually always wanted to go and work a harvest with wineries. When I started working at Fast Cuts, the last advertising place I was in, one of their employees left and like went to be a grape grower in Texas. And I was always like, that's neat. I want to go work for him. But you have to just like drop your life for 3 months at a time. And it's really, you just like can't. So
it's not like a part-time job.
No, it's not. So I was being kind of held back by fear, motivated by fear. And my partner, I decided to move to Australia and it kind of just like ripped that Band-Aid off and I just went for it.
Nice.
And I do want to like pause here for a PSA. Because any of our listeners under the age of 30, go get a working holiday visa. Because you can go to so many different countries. You can stay for a year, work and live there. I mean, Singapore's on the list, New Zealand, Australia, South Korea, Ireland. And just spend your 20s traveling and like living, because what else are you doing here? Like buying a house and like getting married? You're too young to do that. Go, go, live your life.
You do you, boo. But the important thing about this thing is once you turn 30, you can't get this visa.
You can't, and you can still go, but it's just harder. And I just wish someone had told me about it before I turned 30. So go do that. PSA.
All right.
So,
tell me a little bit about, you mentioned some of the things you were doing at the different wineries, but what exactly does a harvest entail? Like, so you were picking, were you stomping? Is there fermentation involved? What is happening during this couple of months?
Yeah. So my experience with the first winery was literally picking the grapes. We'd wake up at 6 a.m. The vineyard manager would tell us which blocks were ripe and ready that day, and he would drive us out there in the bed of a truck. We were covered up head to toe with long sleeves and hats because the sun was super duper intense. Mm-hmm. We brought our own clippers and, okay, well, I brought gloves. Not everyone brought gloves, but I did because everyone's
smart.
Bagoo, you would go to like grab a bunch of grapes and like 40 earwigs would run out of it.
What is even an earwig? It sounds horrible.
Yeah.
I'll have to find a picture. It's like,
is it like a bug?
It's a bug. It's kind of like a silverfish, but it's like aggressive. It's a wiggly.
Oh my
god.
It's
squirmy.
Okay. And you are always the most prepared ones of our friends. So like, good for you.
Oh, super duper prepared.
Well played.
My mom is why I'm always so prepared. She was like,
and your dad.
Yeah, dad too. Oh, yeah.
So you come from a long line of cautious people.
Plus, you don't want to like snip your finger and stuff when you're like, you know, cutting grapes. So, you listen to your podcast, a playlist, crawl around the vines for hours a day, snipping off these, like, full, plump bunches of grapes. And you fill up bucket after bucket, and you toss them into these larger bins in this truck. You're chatting with people from all over the world and backpackers just, you know, picking up side work.
Nice.
Grapes. Yeah, it was really interesting. And then at the end of the day, we'd hop back in the truck. The grape grower would maybe go sell his grapes to a larger winery or put aside the bins to process in his own wineries.
Okay.
And that's where the process would kind of join up for all three. So at this point, it's up to the winemaker if you want to douse the grapes in like kind of a sulfur treatment to stop the natural yeasts on the skins from doing their thing. So we've talked about that in the past. And
the spontaneous fermentation. Yeah.
Whether you want those natural yeasts or not. So
those natties.
Those natty. okay. So then they use a forklift. They raise up the bins of grapes. They dump them into a hopper that delivers the fruit into a crusher or destemmer.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what you're going to do with the wine, you take the grapes and stems, just the crushed grapes or just the juice to a fermentation tank.
Okay.
Which is where the magic happens.
Yes. And can I ask something before you go forward? You mentioned earlier a wood basket press.
Yeah, yeah.
What is that?
Okay, so for instance, in that instance, they were fermenting red wine. And you ferment it for a couple days on the skin, on the juice, everything. The juice starts to separate from the skins. The skins float up to the top. And then you drain off the juice, but still half the juice is still kind of like in the skins.
Mm-hmm.
So you put it into a press. And then the press gently squeezes the juice out without extracting too much tannins or anything.
Mm.
And a lot of places now use stainless steel hydraulic presses.
Okay.
But some smaller wineries or independent wineries still use practice of like wood presses or wood baskets.
Oh, cool.
Or a combination of wood basket with a hydraulic press. So
that's awesome. And is that you press it and then you're left with the must, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, just to bring some vocabulary back in.
Yeah. So, yeah. Sorry, hold on.
Way to go with the vocab.
I'm just like connecting it in my brain.
I know, brilliant. When do the girls stomp on the grapes?
Thank you. That's exactly where I was going. Okay, so depending on what you're doing is what you bring with it. So at Rusden, actually, they were making a wine, and the winemaker chose to ferment a batch of wine with 60% crushed grapes from the machine and 40% only gently macerated. So that meant the stem was still on, and we did. We got in there in, like, rubber boots and Wellingtons and, like, smushed around, stomped around, just to, like, kind of gently squish them. It's not, like, super common, but it's not, like, unheard of either.
What's, like, the difference? Why? Why do that?
Because the machine can be pretty aggressive, I believe, and maybe you don't want to, like, crush them that much or because the more you crush them, I think the more, like, again, tannins are extracted and, like, from the stems and seeds and things like that. So if it's maybe, like, a more delicate grape.
It gives
more,
it that, like, foot-crafted taste.
Yeah, you know, that toe massage. So, yeah, anyways, in South Australia, we were primarily making red wine.
Oh, excellent.
Cabernet Sauvignon, Shiraz, Grenache, and GSM, which is a Côte d'Or blend. It just stands for the three grapes in it, Grenache, Shiraz, and Matera or Mourvèdre.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the first few days of fermentation happens on skin contact.
Because that'll give it color, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's where the characteristic of the wine, the color, flavor, smell, all of that comes mostly from the skin.
Excellent.
So each day we would test the ferments for temperatures, the Bome reading, which is the same as basically like the Brix reading or sugar levels.
Mm.
The Bome use specific gravity, and it's more of like a European, French, Southern Hemisphere thing. Brix and is more of like an American thing.
Okay.
We would do the pH, prepare samples, send to a local lab. Yeah, and that would tell us like a lot of things about the ferment, like how active the yeasts were and when to control the temperature of the ferment and when to add nutrients and acids and tannins and when to take it off the skins.
Very cool.
So, yeah, it was really neat learning that process.
That's amazing.
Several times a day we would do pushdowns or pump overs, which is just mixing in oxygen, keeping the cap wet so all the skins float to the top and form a cap.
Okay.
You want to keep that moist. And then when the wine's ready, you rack it off of the skin or like drain it off. We put it into other clean fermentation tanks. You let it settle out there. And that's when I saw a pretty huge variation in the techniques of the winemaking between each of the places.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about them.
This really small place in organic wine would just kind of like unique variations and all, like throw it in the barrel. Like that wine was just the way it was that year, and that's where it was going.
Okay.
But at the bigger one at Soul Growers, this is where they would like do a lot of tests, add, you know, whatever water or like, basically add chemicals and manipulate the wine in a way that made it very consistent and very stable.
Right. Okay. So this is the part where you're talking about like the lab and the control.
Yes.
And all of that.
Yeah. And like the larger scale production places typically do that for consistency's sake.
Yeah. Same with beer. Like when I visited Miller Coors in Fort Worth, I was like so impressed by their lab. They're like, this is exactly how we study it and know exactly how to make it the same every single time. And that is like totally impressive in its own way, you know, that they can set the temperature or set the environmental factors to make sure that you can drink that beer tomorrow. You can drink that beer in 100 years in 100 different places, and it will always be the same.
Wow, that's crazy. And power to them. I hope that works.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a preference.
Yeah. So eventually all of the wineries, red wine would end up in barrels. Some wineries use brand new oak barrels or French oak and American or French, and others utilized used barrels depending on how much flavor they wanted to impart or, you know, how much money they wanted to spend.
Sure.
So
can't
we would
blame them.
steam and sterilize those barrels and flip them over and fill them up with that year's vintage.
Holy shit.
I know.
You
were like,
really
rolled
part
a barrel.
Of, you were part of literally the whole process.
The whole process. It's really cool. So then depending on the size of the winery, so that would be happening from anywhere to 5 to 20 batches of wine at a time. So like different days, maybe grapes came in. Maybe you moved wine around to different fermentation tanks. Maybe you cleaned out old ones. It was just like a big ballet or a big like choreography
like
dance.
There was a cadence depending on the timing.
It was crazy. So, yep. And then I also did a little extra work from like the year before, like track old barrels of aging wine from previous vintages, climb in those racks, take samples, labeled bottles from last year, wax sealed them, got them ready for distribution. And
that sounds fun.
It was neat. Yeah.
What was your favorite part of the process?
Gosh, what was my favorite part? I probably really like the early mornings, like outdoors, like the early mornings in the vineyards was really beautiful and peaceful.
I'm
and I could
sure.
get into the agricultural side of that. But all that's a beautiful story. But I should mention the one thing you do first and foremost more than anything, as you know from homebrewing, is clean, 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 clean. Like you're constantly spraying shit down, putting shit away.
Everywhere.
That's the number one thing you do more than anything.
Yeah, I'm sure. And that's what a lot of people who volunteer at breweries say, too. It's like you always start literally cleaning everything.
Yeah.
Awesome. So were you being paid to do all this heavy lifting?
So it depends on the situation. This year in Oregon, I will be being paid. But for instance, at Small Fry, where I picked grapes, there's 15 of us living in a house with one toilet and one shower.
Oh, my.
And
That's a lot of roommates.
Yes, it was. It was an experience. And the majority of them were doing something called woofing.
What?
Right. I never heard of it either. I was like, did you say roofing? Are you roofing the winery? Is what I thought. I was like, wow, he hired a lot of amateur roofers.
Okay.
Yeah. No. Woofers. So that stands for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms.
Oh.
So there's this website and like organization that puts this network together of countries and farms. And then you travel to organic farms and work a length of time. Maybe a week to several months, and the farm provides you housing and food while you're there.
Interesting.
So you just kind of like exist.
So it's a lifestyle.
Yes, it's a lifestyle choice. Yes. Yeah. Which is how I was meeting a lot of those people, and I was like, "You guys are."
I thought they were over there. Like, when you said it, I thought they were back there hoofing paint or something.
Yeah, me too. I thought that was like a thing you guys did after a day on the vineyard.
No, but I loved it. I met some amazing people at the first winery from Japan, Germany, Italy, France, New York, California, Australia. I learned some amazing cooking techniques. But it was a little bit like Cinderella Farmhouse.
Oh my gosh.
With that many people cooking in the kitchen, it meant a lot of like little mice friends, and you could hear them running around the attic.
Oh my God.
I know. And the house was so packed, I had to sleep on a pallet in the living room floor in front of the fireplace, where like literally every morning I would wake up before dawn to see like the first little rays of the morning light like shining through the chimney into like the cinder ash filled fireplace.
That is such a beautiful silver lining.
It was so like poetically like beautiful. I was like, you know what, I'm only gonna be here 10 days, like just gonna embrace this experience.
I don't know, man.
So there's some beauty in
were
it.
Were there like snakes?
That's
what I would have been scared
like,
of
in the
right?
house.
Yeah, that's where my
with
mind
the mice
goes.
Maybe in the we did get some snake biting advice for when we were picking in the vineyards. So apparently you're not supposed to like run around, you just be still and everyone else gets you help because it's hot, you don't want your heart beating faster, and like that was a tip.
So
survival tip for you guys.
So definitely some snakes.
But the next two wineries I stayed at, I had full farmhouses pretty much to myself. So that was neat.
Wow.
So like free Airbnb.
Yeah. And so depending on the winery, some lodging is on the property of the winery. Some are located on vineyards. They are owned by the wineries. And they try to keep you close if they're providing housing. But a lot of wineries don't. And you just have to find temporary lodging in the area, which is actually what influenced my choice in Oregon. I chose a winery in Oregon that supplies housing. So I'll be rooming with all the other seasonal
Very cool.
Harvest workers.
Okay, so are you going to be at one place in Oregon, or are you traveling like you did in Australia?
I will be at one place in Oregon the whole time, but I will, like, pop around and, like, sip tasting rooms
other
places.
Okay, but you're only working at one. Sleeping at one.
Mm-hmm.
On a bed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Hopefully with, like, some air conditioning and not in a barn.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully. But, I mean, I don't think there is central air conditioning in, like, Oregon and stuff, right?
There might not be. I don't really know.
I don't know. Hopefully they have heating when it gets cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, before we get too deep into what you'll be doing there, I feel like we should spend a little bit of time in the Willamette Valley.
Yeah.
Are you so proud that I said it correctly?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I used to call it Willamette all the time. But
I
when
was
I
more
was...
like, yeah, Willamette.
The Willamette Valley. But when I was doing the interviews, a few people stopped me down and were like, it's Willamette.
Okay.
I was like,
so pick it up.
Yeah. Thank you for the correction.
Well, and anyone who drinks wine has probably heard of this region. It's an area that's between Oregon's Cascade Mountains, like the brewery that I'm drinking is named for.
Mm-hmm.
It's between the Cascade Mountains and the Coast Range, and it spans nearly 3.5 million acres, and it's gorgeous. I've driven through it on my way.
Ooh, have you?
Yeah, when I flew into Portland, Maddie and I did a road trip down to Port Orford, and we stopped in not Montrose. Montrose is now in Colorado. It's an M little town out there.
I'll
and you drive through, and we were just on the sides of the highway, like vineyards for days.
It's so beautiful.
So why don't you give us a little bit of background about that wine region?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, when I tell stories, I love to get a little bit of context. So let's start 15 million years ago.
I'm just kidding. Oh, my God. Here she goes again.
No, but, you know, I have a degree in geology, and it is, like, actually important to, like, the wine itself. So just really quickly, Western Oregon of the state long ago, 15 million years ago, used to be the ocean floor in the Pacific. So that collected deep and shallow marine sediments that were full of minerals and nutrients. Mm-hmm. So over time, the Pacific and North American tectonic plates began to smoosh together and create rising earth, which are, as you mentioned, the Cascade Range and the Coast Range. And that's a little Willamette Valley between them. So now the Cascade Range was rife with volcanic activity. So it covered all of this marine sediment with igneous rock called basalt. As that began to churn and buckle and mix, a lot of other silt blew in. And then the icing on the cake was when there was a Ice Age glacial flood from Missoula, Montana, and that brought mud, silt, and sand into this really great valley in a really great location with, like, diurnal shifts, great elevation. So it was just, like, meant to be.
Yeah, if you go to the coast, you can totally see that. There's, like, there are beaches, but it's mostly just, like, rock face into the ocean.
Yeah. And I'm so excited about hiking and everything when I get there, too. Aside from actually, like, the agricultural side of thing, like, oh. It's going to be so beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's going to be a great time of year to be there.
So commercial production of agriculture and wine didn't really start there until pioneers got there. So you remember that game, Oregon Trail?
Of course I do.
Yeah. So they were trying to get to this luscious, fertile, gorgeous.
In Oregon?
Yeah.
You don't say.
Yeah, in Oregon. So the pioneers that didn't succumb to dysentery started producing wine and alcohol as soon as they could.
I don't blame them.
Yeah. So, and then whatever industry or culture Oregon had around wine production came to a dead stop in 1920 with
Prohibition. Womp, womp. Yeah. Okay, this is official request for a sound effect for Prohibition.
Yeah.
All right, I'll get that.
Because it kills the party every episode.
Every episode.
Oregon didn't get its, like, groove back until three decades after repeal in 1933, when in the mid-60s, the first commercial wineries were established and the first commercial Pinot Noir vines were planted in Oregon.
Wow, that is so recent.
Yeah, it is a very recent industry there, actually. So in the 1970s, a ton of out-of-state winemakers kind of got wind of what was happening there, and they all moved to Oregon and bolstered and structured the industry. And by the end of that decade, Oregon was recognized globally as a quality wine-producing region.
It was in the Norwegian.
In the Norwegians. As a quality wine-producing region at the Wine Olympics in France.
Wine Olympics? Why have I never been to this?
You know, I heard about that when I went on that tour in Trefethen. I was like, that's interesting. It was put on by, I believe, a food and wine magazine in France.
Oh, awesome.
Anyway, so the Pinot Noir that won in 1979 actually belonged to Erie Vineyards, which was the very first winery and commercial Pinot Noir vines planted in the Willamette Valley.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know.
I'm into that.
Diana, what a coincidence, right? Diana and David Lett, or Papa Pino, as he's lovingly was lovingly known.
Ooh, Daddy Pino.
Started production in the Willamette Valley in 1966, and today there are over 300 wineries and 15,000 acres of planted vineyards in the Willamette Valley.
Damn.
I've heard amazing things about the nature, the beauty, the quality of the wine, so I'm just really jazzed to get out there.
Ah, me too, and I'm excited for you. Correct me if I'm wrong, you're going to Lemelson Vineyards?
Lemelson Vineyards.
Okay, great. I want to know everything about it. How old is it? What kind of grapes do they grow? The whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah,
lay it on me.
So, Lemelson Vineyards planted their first vines even more recently in 1995. They had their first vintage in 1999, and they released their first wine publicly in 2001.
Wow.
Right? They have 7 estate vineyards in the area, and all of them are organically certified, which actually is a pretty big common thing in Oregon as a whole, to be sustainable and organic.
That does not surprise me at all.
Sometime in the 90s, I think, like, a politician really, like, pushed for that, if I can remember correctly from reading. So, yeah, they produce Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, and Riesling.
Wow, so quite a diverse bunch.
Yeah, and those are pretty common grapes for the area, though, too.
Okay.
They're kind of right weather, and everyone's jamming on that. So the Lemelson Winery actually caught my eye as I was researching wineries to apply to because I really like their story. The owner, Eric Lemelson, is an environmental lawyer and an activist, but fell in love with Pinot Noir and started making wine in the 90s.
nice.
Right? So I was like, your life is
excellent.
Amazing.
Yeah.
He built the facilities using a plethora of sustainable materials from the area. And the coolest part is the winery is designed built over several floors to utilize gravity flow instead of constantly running electric pumps to move the wine.
That is incredible.
Wow, right?
That's amazing. What a great idea.
I know. And also weird, they also have this like kind of big one-of-a-kind designed mobile sorting platform on the winery floor. And it's just like this big machine that like rolls up and down the fermentation tanks. And anywho.
Okay, I don't know anything about that, but.
I know. So this is where it gets like a little twisted. So it sounds like really like robot-y and futuristic, right?
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So Eric Lemelson's dad is a gentleman named Jerome Lemelson. Jerome Lemelson. Ooh, that's a mouthful. And he was a prolific American inventor. So Jerome Lemelson's first major project in the 50s was when he helped design a universal industrial robot that did things like weld, sort, move, and scared all the Americans that they were going to lose their jobs
to
robots.
They took their jobs. He was the cause of that.
In the 70s, he helped create a patent that later sold to Sony as the video cassette player.
Heard of it.
Wow, right. Yeah. And he also sold word processing technology to IBM and circuit technology to Texas Instruments. So he was obviously a big influence on this, like, cutting edge winery design.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing.
So I like this winery because it's a crazy blend of sustainable and environmentally conscious vineyard management and winemaking swirled up with innovation and invention. It's a philosophy I absolutely agree with and I want to impart into my career. So I'm excited to see how they do things and learn from them.
Yeah, that sounds like it'll be a ton of fun. Definitely out of the ordinary.
Yes, yes. I'm pumped.
So when you're at Lemelson, do you expect you'll be doing something similar to what you were doing in Australia, or will it be different?
Yeah, I think it'll be similar in a lot of ways, you know, learning the workflow and the protocol of the winery, early mornings, long days, hard work, delegation, teamwork. Mm-hmm. In that sense, the science and procedures behind the winemaking, I'm interested to see how it'll differ because, for instance, South Australia is a warm climate growing region and the Pacific Northwest is a cool climate.
Sure.
Cool climate warming. Mm-hmm. There's a higher rainfall where I'm going compared to where I've been.
Absolutely.
And also, I'm excited to be there long enough to get my bearings. So the other place is only there for 10 days. And right as I was getting comfortable and like feeling confident to like kind of do things on my own, mm-hmm. it was time to leave and go to the next place. So yeah. I'm super excited to like really get a bearing. And they are also going to forklift certify me. So when you see me this winter,
boy.
I'm going to be forklift certified, bitches.
You're going to be a whole new woman.
Yeah. And I'm going to be in a new pay grade. I'm going to be like lifting. I'm gonna be like, you need to move that. You need to move that heavy thing.
Yeah.
I'll get that for you. So yeah, I think it'll some things will be the same, but some things will be different. It'll just be like grow on the last experience for sure.
Yeah. Did you say that you're actually gonna be picking grapes too?
I don't think in this scenario I will. I was entertaining the idea of maybe going out there a little early and working in the vineyard because I had shown an interest in the interview, but I couldn't get back to America early enough to do that, unfortunately.
Oh, gotcha. So that process will already be done by the time you get there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. They needed me like a while ago.
Great.
If I was going to do that. But yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I think we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Surprises.
So what would you say is the biggest thing you learned in Australia that you'll take with you?
Oh, gosh. Okay. So this sounds like a little silly, but outside of like the winemaking itself, for me, this experience, the biggest thing I learned was like to be brave, to like just go after what I want. Or you want, or anyone wants. Like, life is too short, man, you know?
Sure, yeah.
I look at our grandparents and our parents, and time is passing very rapidly. Yeah. And I just hear and see the things that they regret not doing in their own lives. And I really don't want that for us. And it is scary going for whatever that thing is in your life and putting yourself out there or taking that risk. And sometimes it won't work. But I'd rather try than not. Like,
right?
Every yeah. single time. And so Australia taught me the importance of being bold, like their Shiraz. trying to master my apprehension, moving things forward to accomplish goals every day. You know, it's possible for everyone. You just actually have to do it instead of talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in one of those moments right now, so I can completely feel
you know,
that. Yeah.
And I was a little nervous about driving cross country by myself and like going to live and work by myself in a state I've never been to. But actually thinking about this interview and these questions has really made me like journal and evaluate why I'm doing this. So thank
sure.
you for processing this with me.
Yeah, really, you're welcome. I even bought you a journal excited. Before the last time you went to Australia. Oh, yeah. Did you ever use it?
I did.
That's sweet.
I know.
Because I bought it for you, I get to read everything in it.
Okay. Whoa, that's a deal you have to make before. That's a deal with the devil if I ever heard one. All
right.
She'll need a little time before that happens.
Oh, Lordy.
Last question, and it's a doozy.
Okay.
Are you going to miss me?
Oh, my God. Duh. Yeah, so much. So much. But I'm also... I can't tell you how excited I am for you and your German adventure.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I wish I could be there with you and you could be there with me, but I know we're going to each have an amazing experience and find wonderful stories to share with our listeners. Speaking of which, our listeners can look for a future episode highlighting Oktoberfest and your very own German travels and German roots.
Yeah, so I am headed to Germany. We're going to do... a little preview of that. I'm headed over there to go to Oktoberfest. I'm also going to see some of my family that lives over there. I'm very, very excited. And Laura and I are going to record a lot of audio along the way. I think you guys are going to be really excited what we come back with.
Yeah, it's going to be badass. So make sure you go over to Apple Podcasts and subscribe. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Grapes and Grain Podcast. And pledge your monthly support to keep our booze-soaked information flowing at patreon.com/grapesandgrain.
Yeah, and Laura, thanks so much for sharing with us about Oregon. Cannot tell you how excited
Yay,
I am for you. So I'll
too.
Raise a glass to you.
You're
yeah.
so brave.
So brave.
So
yeah.
Brave.
Oh my God. How lame does that sound now in this context?
No. No,
cheers. Just do it.
Like,
go for the thing you want in your life.
But,
no.
Right, but you know, the older you get, the harder it
exactly.
is.
My mom's talking about doing it now at 65. And I'm like,
yeah,
now or never.
Right.
Every day, now or never.
I'm scared to leave.
Yeah. go, Ben. Run away, Ben.
Across the
Fly
street.
Fly like the wind, Ben.
Yeah.
Oh, I believe in you. Cheers, guys.
The end.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured on our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Grapes and Grain Podcast. Remember, that's grapes plural and grain singular.
Find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.com to see blog posts that go more in depth to each episode. You can also download or stream the podcast there.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. And a huge thank you to Jack and Dorothy Studios for having us in today. We couldn't do it without you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today. Cheers.
Cheers.
What you drinking?